Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of not only the books that I have authored, but some articles that I have written. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there information describing the books I have authored, one of them co-authored with my daughter. In fact, that book, The Finality of Jesus Christ, is not a long book, but it's a very important book, and if anybody will let the Scriptures answer their questions about whether there are many ways to God, this will be decisive. Another very important book I've written is Polishing God's Monuments, Pillars of Hope for Punishing Times. I've written a book on marriage. Should help a lot of people if both are serious about walking with God in their marriage. Marriage Without Remorse, Rules for the Road. And finally, one about the pastoral ministry would be good for elders and leaders, too. Dispatches from the Front Lines, Reflections on the Glory and Grind of Pastoral Ministry. On top of that, on the same website, you'll see a tab that says Articles. If you will open that with your cursor, you will discover there are some articles that I've produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. For example, one of the most recent articles was my take on the demise of the culture wars and where I think we ought to go from here. Another article that appeared several years ago in a journal for biblical manhood and womanhood is entitled Boundaries Without Bonds. Another is a rebuttal of a tract that appeared several years back. The author attempted cleverly, but as I will show unsuccessfully, to persuade us that the Scriptures do not condemn homosexual practice after all. That has all been a misunderstanding. Well, there will be others, but I mentioned those three. I'm not a regular blogger, but when sometimes things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article like some of these. We continue our exposition of the book of Acts. We're in Acts chapter 19. We have just encountered this narrative about the great hostile demonstration against Paul in Ephesus. There was a great disturbance led by one Demetrius and his fellow craftsmen. They were complaining as a result of Paul's preaching and the many conversions about the decline of the worship of Diana and also the threat to their silversmithing trade. So the city was filled with confusion, we read in verse 29. They rushed with one accord into the theater. They drug along Gaius and Aristarchus, Paul's traveling companions from Macedonia. Well, Paul, ever brave, wanted to go into the assembly, but the disciples would not permit that. We read in verse 31 that some of the Asiarchs, who were friends of Paul's, sent to him and repeatedly urged him not to venture into the theater. Way too dangerous. So then, some were shouting one thing, some another, for the assembly was in confusion. The majority did not even know for what cause they had come together. Mobs moved by impulse and not always a rational impulse. Some of the crowd concluded that it was Alexander, since the Jews had put him forward. We'll cover that again. Having motioned with his hand for silence, to get the opportunity to speak, this Alexander was intending to make a defense to the assembly, not a Christian defense, but a Jewish defense, and we'll explain that. Well, when they recognized that he was a Jew, in their congenital anti-Semitism, a single outcry arose from them as they all shouted for about 2 hours. Great is Artemis of the Ephesians! Great is Artemis of the Ephesians! And on and on and on. Well, we'll stop right there for the moment. We'll pick up with verse 33. This is kind of a sidebar, but it's an interesting one. Some of that Ephesian crowd concluded that it was Alexander, since the unbelieving Jews had put him forward as their spokesman, put him forward to explain the situation in a manner they hoped that would deflect the heat from the Jews and on to Paul and his associates only. So Alexander was intending to make a defense, as I say, a defense of the Jews, whom the pagans did not differentiate from Christians. So when they recognized that he was a Jew, considering him part of the problem in their Jewish opposition to idolatry, that generated a single outcry, and they shouted hysterically for about the space of 2 hours. I always say when people get shrill like that, it's because they feel threatened. I don't care who it is when you get that shrill. It's because you're scared. The Jews, who on the one hand hated Paul and his message about Christ, I'm sure they were thrilled at one level that this mob violence just might succeed in eliminating Paul. But they also had a problem. They were torn and ambivalent. This mob scene was a double-edged sword, because mobs are emotional, not reasoning, gatherings of people. They knew that this Gentile rabble was incapable of nuance. No way were they ever going to distinguish between Jews and these Christians, because at this early time, everybody tended to look at the Christians as just a subsect of the Jews. So the Jews, in order to kind of fend off the hostility that might get focused on them, they put forward one Alexander, and they wanted him to speak for them, and so they were hoping to distance the Jewish community from the message of Paul. That, they thought, would shield them from the violent spillover against Paul and his team of Christian evangelists, those preaching Christ. Alexander, no doubt, would have tried in the process not to quell their rage, but to focus it and redirect it against Christians and deflect their fury from the Jews. But somehow, recognizing him as a Jew, they saw him as part of their problem. For the Jews, as we all know, were known worldwide as our Christians, as monotheist. So the crowd only grew more agitated. It was a pagan crowd. It was a polytheistic crowd. And like partisans at a pep rally, they shouted a single mantra for an unbelievable 2 hours, nonstop, saying, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." This tactic is classic rhetoric over reason, propaganda over truth. Classic intimidation tactic. If enough people say it and continue to say it and do so long enough, then people will believe it, whether it is true or not, and they'll be afraid to say otherwise if they do not believe it. Nobody wants to be an outsider and be treated like an alien, so you have to get on board. That's mob psychology. But there's another lesson here for us Christians in facing the antagonism of the world. Folks, I've made this point repeatedly in my studies, and if you listen regularly, this is certainly not the first time you've heard it, but it bears repeating. Some believers suffer from the illusion that if only the world knew us Christians, they would love us. They believe that the world's suspicion and enmity is all because too many Christians out there give the world the wrong idea of what we're all about. In that way, they're reasoning just like the Jews were in putting forward Alexander. Now, look, it is true. There is a fringe and hypocritical element in every movement, and there are some professing Christians and some Christian groups that are, to me and to you, a distinct embarrassment to the cause of Christ. I certainly want to disassociate myself from them, and I would certainly like the opportunity to say to the world, hey, whatever you think, we are not them. We are not like them. We understand why you consider them turkeys. They are. But we're eagles. We're safe. I mean, that temptation is always there to feel that way. Well, just forget it. Just forget it, folks. While we may feel that way, you see, the problem is not the medium. The problem is the message. The world fears the gospel. The world does not want Christ. You can put any Christian Alexander up there if you want to and try to have him make your case and say, we are not like them. If you knew us, you would love us. That is a fallacy. That is a myth. That is a delusion. You see, the world does not want to obey God. No, the truth is, if the world really knew us and really understood us, listen, they would not love us any more than the pagans would have been fine with the Jews. Again, yes, of course, there are misguided Christians out there. There are false brethren out there passing themselves under our names, and they misrepresent what we're all about. We know that. There are people out there flying under our flag, and they bring enormous reproach on Christ. But no matter, folks, at the end of the day, they just serve as another convenient excuse for people who want to reject Christ to persist in rejecting Christ and to do what they want to do anyway, and that's smear Christians. So these folks that we may shy away from and that we deplore, they're not the reason the world feels as they do. Don't ever get that idea in your head. The thing about it is, how many times I've said it, it's not a notion that begins with me. It's clearly in John chapter 3, verses 18 and following. The world loves darkness, and it hates light, and it finds light a threat. Just like they hated Jewish monotheism, among other things Jewish, in their paganism. Jewish monotheism was not Christianity, but still it was a source of some light into the pagan darkness. And it just rankled the pagans and expressed itself in a latent anti-Semitism. It's a little more to it than that, but we'll leave aside the nuances for the moment. Well, in verse 35, finally, the town clerk, that was an important civilian post in Roman arrangements. This guy was a past master at crowd control. He quiets the assembly with a compelling speech, that is, compelling to them. After quieting the multitude, the town clerk said, "Men of Ephesus, come on now," I paraphrase, "what man is there who, after all, does not know that the city of Ephesus is guardian of the temple of the great Artemis, and does not know that the city of Ephesus is the guardian of the image which fell down from heaven?" A little background for us there. In the words of a Christian scholar, Artemis was not the fair and chaste huntress of Greek mythology. Artemis, the goddess, was a Near Eastern mother goddess of fertility. She was depicted as a grotesque, multi-breasted woman. Her rites included features of pagan nature worship, and that always involved sexual immorality. The image of her, they claimed, was fallen from heaven, was, some say, a meteorite, which, with an active imagination, resembled a woman with many breasts. Other meteorites were considered sacred cult objects and worshipped at other Greek cities such as Troy, Pessinus, Enna, and Emesa. The temple of Artemis in Ephesus was 420 feet in length, 239 feet wide. It was considered in its magnificence one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. The whole metropolitan economy was built around this attraction and her worship. People in that world streamed to it like pilgrims and tourists stream to Jerusalem and Israel today, among other tourist attractions around the world. The town clerk points out the obvious. "Come on, people, settle down. Take a chill pill. Who in the world does not know that the city of Ephesus is the acknowledged guardian of this magnificent temple of Artemis, which allegedly fell down from heaven? Since these facts are acknowledged everywhere, don't act so threatened," he tells them. "Don't do anything rash that's going to bring us into trouble with the authorities." Verses 36 through 37, he says, "Since these are undeniable facts," there he was pandering to their religious prejudices by embracing their pagan myths as if they were historical facts, "you ought to keep calm and do nothing rash," for he meant you are seriously flirting with grave danger here of retribution from the authorities. "For you have brought these men here who are neither robbers of temples, they're not blasphemers of our goddess, thus an exonerative testimony for a key public official that it was not the Christians who were the cause of this public disorder, but their enemies. The only kind of criminal activity that would justify such disorder and lawless uproar would be the forms of sacrilege that this city official declared them innocent of." These were offenses so commonly charged against the Jews, even by Paul himself in Romans chapter 2. So now the city official declares if there are any legal issues involved, there are proper channels of adjudication of these matters, and that is the proper recourse. So, folks, put up or shut up. You can see the hand of God, the unseen hand of God in all of this, in protecting his servants. So then, he says, if Demetrius and his craftsmen who are with him have a complaint, a legitimate complaint against any man, hey, the courts are in session, the proconsuls are available, let them bring charges against one another. But if you want anything beyond this, it shall be settled in a lawful assembly. Or I tell you, we are in danger of being accused of a riot in connection with today's affair. And that's serious, because there's no real cause for it. There's another exonerative concession. And in this connection, we shall be unable to account for this disorderly gathering. And after saying this, he dismissed the assembly, and he said, like an old Western marshal, everybody just clear out and go home. Of the many slanders against Christ, the Apostle Paul and the Christians, particularly those slanders voiced by the unbelieving Jews, one was that the apostle was a source of stirring up trouble of doing things illegal. This affair in Ephesus presents a good opportunity for Luke to show that Paul and the Christians might be the occasion of lawless activity, but they were by no means the source of it. That's something quite different. And folks, may it ever be so that the record will show that we Christians are never the source of public tumult or guilty of any lawlessness, unless the world outlaws doing the will of God. I want to say this. I personally think we must be very cautious, especially when we join in the protest mode that media-savvy special interest groups go into for the sake of creating a media event to draw attention to a good cause, or what they think is a good cause. And in the process, they engage in lawless or incendiary behaviors. And if we get involved in that, that could make us Christians appear to be the source and not just the occasion of these outbreaks of civil convulsions. John MacArthur has made the ironic observation that, quote, when these Christian men passed under the protection of the pagan town clerk, let me put it another way, under the protection of local politicians, they were in more danger, I would add spiritually speaking, than when Demetrius was howling about them. Now, how could MacArthur make a statement like that? It's a curious statement. Because, he asserts, the church's love for the Lord had passed under the cooling process of the city's protection and patronage. Now, to tell you the truth, I'm not sure that I agree with that outcome on this occasion. That said, however, MacArthur makes a sound point in general, and the sound point is this, that persecution is not nearly the enemy of the spiritual fervor of God's people as those times of relative tranquility when the church, as today, especially back in the 80s and 90s, when the church carries the favor and the patronage of secular politicians and the media. Let me say something, folks. If you don't mind the metaphor, put it in your pipe and smoke it. The world's favors never come cheap. And whenever the church tries to gain power, influence, or protection from the world, compromise will ensue. You've just got to take that to the bank. It's very corrupting. We should keep our distance from politicians in the sense that we believers should never court them. We should never depend upon them for our protection. We should never, in my opinion, ask favors of them, for inevitably there will be a price to pay. I'll tell you a story. It doesn't have to do with politicians. It's a little more extreme than that. But you can see the dangers inherent in this illustration. When my wife and I were in Denver, we were in a megachurch. Not a mega-megachurch, but in a megachurch at 1,700 or 1,800 people. I very much loved our pastor and his wife. There were things I admired about him, things I didn't admire about him. But he had more leadership in one finger than most men have in their whole bodies. And in a lot of ways, I was indebted to him. But a thing happened one Sunday that is at once humorous and at the same time, man, it was dangerous. He was very security conscious, but in spite of all of that, it had to be a professional job. On a Sunday afternoon, Some professional thieves managed to enter our church and run off with all of our sound equipment. Now, we're talking about the 1970s, and that was $100,000 worth of sound equipment, so you can just adjust that for inflation, and you know what we're talking about. Well, this was bad. This was terrible news. Bob was a worldly man in the best sense of the term. He knew his way around the block. He was a man that could kind of whip a bear with a switch. You could drop him anywhere in the world all by himself, and he knew how to survive. He was a very unusual fellow. Well, what he did is just say to himself, look, we got a professional job here. I want that equipment back, and I think I know how to get it. He knew Denver's well-known crime family. At that time, I guess they still are, they were the Smaldones. He got on the phone, managed to get somebody in the upper level of that crime family, and he said to them, you know, I'm so-and-so, I'm the pastor of such-and-such a church. Here's what happened. This is a professional job. I know that whatever you guys do that's outside the law, you don't do this to churches. And you probably won't like this. So I'm just asking you to do us a favor. You see if you can find out who it is. We don't need names. We don't need anything like that, but we do need our equipment back. Would you believe it? In just a short space of time, I don't remember whether it was hours or days, somebody called our pastor and said, you can find your equipment at such and such a place. I think it was in an alley. And lo and behold, they went there and got it. Equipment saved. Well, isn't that great? Oh, that's just like trusting in the politicians. No, that's not great. Because now they've given you that favor. That kind of puts you in a position to return a favor. Maybe an illegal favor. You just don't want to go there. And that's what the church has been doing, playing footsie with the world for the last 20 or 30 years. So, let me kind of sum up here. We see here what the vision of one man can accomplish. If that vision, powered by the Spirit of God, is followed with courage and energy. That's Paul in Ephesus. We see that doing God's work in God's way, as he did there in Ephesus, is both rewarding and risky. But it can be as frightful as it is fruitful. Thirdly, we see how God sets a protective hedge about his faithful servants there in Ephesus, so long as it serves his purposes to shield them. It doesn't always serve God's purposes to shield us, but so long as it does, he will protect us. Fourthly, we see that it is not the power of Paul, but it's the power of God working through the apostle that turned Ephesus upside down for Christ. Fifth, we see that no triumph for Christ is ever secure if the people of God do not retain their first love. We can't help but remember what God said to the church of Ephesus through the angel. You've left your first love, despite all of this that the apostle Paul did. No triumph for Christ is ever secure if the people of God do not retain their first love. I want you to note the secular versus the religious places that he chose to evangelize. I want you to note next the reasoned presentation he made. It was not with a lot of sweat. It was not with a lot of yelling and a lot of mopping of the brow. Paul was a passionate man, but he was also a reasoning man. And finally, I want you to note the extended periods he stayed and the intensity of his labors as he served Christ in all of these places. That brings us to Acts chapter 20, which we're going to look at next, Life Lessons from a Travelogue. Well, God bless you, friends. Have a wonderful day. Join us again next time.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.